Today's show is sponsored by Bob's Red Mill, employee-owned and operated, and founded on the principle of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
From Heritage Radio, it's Why Food, a show about creators, entrepreneurs, and visionaries in the food industry and the stories behind their success. Today, I have Tim and Nancy Cushman with me from Cushman Concepts. Thanks so much for joining me on today on the show today, guys.
Thanks for having us.
It's great to be here.
The last time I had a couple on here was the couple from Ample Hills Creamery. And unfortunately, there was a guy right at the window here slugging a pitcher of beer, looking right at the wife, and she got very nervous. So luckily we've got a nicer crowd outside the windows here today, so it's a much more comfortable setting for an interview. I can thank you that. How are you doing, guys? You've got an amazing setup with Cushman Concepts, with Oh Yeah in Boston and New York. You've got Hojoku in Boston as well, then Covina, and then The Roof at Park South, mm-hmm. which is a seasonal spot you were just telling me.
Yeah,
it keeps us busy.
Absolutely, absolutely. When did this start off? When did OEA start off as the first restaurant?
10 years ago. Well, we just celebrated March 6th, our 10th anniversary.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, thank you. Knock on wood.
And you're still moving as strong as ever?
Yes, we're on a wait list every night still. So yeah. That's a good thing.
Super. Well, you know, one thing that we're going to learn more throughout this interview is that both of you have had very established careers, and you as well, Nancy, before you even stepped foot inside the world of food. So there, between both of you, we could separate this and have two wonderful interviews. But today we have some time constraints, and I want to just get an insight into your lives before you got into the food industry. So I'm going to start with you, Tim, into what introduced you into the world of food.
Probably the way I grew up. We didn't go out to restaurants really at all, because we didn't have money, so we ate at home all the time. So I didn't really have any restaurant exposure or experience prior to cooking. I remember early on, this was after I had graduated from high school. I mean, I did make food when I was growing up, and it was just part of what we did. And I grew up out in the woods on a river. We had a brick fireplace by the river, and we'd fish in the river and light a wood fire and grill the fish over there. We used to sleep out in the front yard with my friends and do that for breakfast. But I never really thought of a career in cooking.
But do you mean at that time that, you know, I suppose looking back on it, did you think, oh, well, I actually really enjoyed it at the time. I just didn't really think much into it.
Well, I love the flavor. And yeah. I actually love the process too. And used to once we got to drinking age, so to speak, I used to have cookouts in the front yard. So I'd invite friends down, and we'd just grill stuff out, and you know, have fun, swim in the river. But a real life changing moment was very early on. I met this girl in Boston who ended up being my girlfriend, but she was from Mexico. She was from LA, but she was Mexican. And she took me to a Mexican restaurant, and I tasted cilantro. This is probably around 1973. And I went, wow.
Cilantro.
So then I called, the restaurant's still open in Boston. It's called Sol Azteca. But I called the restaurant and asked them what was in that. And they told me it was cilantro and I asked where could I buy it, and they said go to Chinatown. And so I went down to Chinatown and I found it, and I've been making salsa ever since, and love it. But in a fun way, also the place where I bought that cilantro is about a 10-minute walk from Oya, so kind of came full circle in a way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know that, you know, growing up, your passion was more so lay in music. Was that something that you sought to pursue? That's what came first. That came before food.
I saw a lot of great live bands when I was growing up. Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin on tour, the original Jefferson Airplane, some, you know, just great bands. We were talking about Queen in the 70s. I saw them 3 times. Jethro Tull. Those are a lot of really kind of older bands. But so I always had this music bug and played guitar. And eventually I ended up playing in bands in the 70s and was in an all-original band called Strongheart. We were together for about 3 years. And then right towards the end, we were about to go on a kind of a mini tour as an opening act on the East Coast for a band. And the lead singer got polyps, and so we had to kind of cancel that. And then it just kind of started falling apart, so I decided I wanted to go try Berklee College of Music in Boston. So I went in and auditioned for that, and I got accepted into the school there and just went through and got my degree in performance in classical and jazz guitar, but I'm a rock and roller. But I just, you know, I wanted to learn theory and technique, because eventually I wanted to go on tour with a band, but I thought eventually when I got older, I'd play in like Johnny Carson's band or something like that and just do studio work. And
at that stage, it was just music, music, music. That's what was,
yes,
that's what was on your mind, right?
Yeah, yeah, it was music. Yeah,
those earlier years of enjoying experimenting, yep, with food were gone. It was just music, music, music.
Well, no, I was still into food at that point, so I still was cooking. Actually, I remember one of the first... The first cookbook I bought, I still have, and it had a calamari dish in it. So, and not many people ate calamari back then, but it was, so I tried it and it came out terrible. It's like, I didn't cook it long enough. So it was like just hard rubber. And, but I didn't get discouraged and I just kept trying. So, but yeah, I was cooking during that time.
And Nancy, how did you get introduced to the food business? Where were you working before you got into the food industry?
Yeah, my background, before meeting Tim, I actually went to school or college, University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. I'm from Chicago, outside of Chicago. So I grew up very Midwestern, very meat and potatoes. Lois, my mom, made like...
Great cook.
Super, yes, thanks, Mom. just real straightforward meals, you know, meat, potato, veg. And we didn't dine out a lot in restaurants. And so went to school for marketing, got a job in advertising, which is really what I wanted to get into in school. I love the balance of kind of creativity and business both with that, which is really applicable now to what we're doing too. So advertising. I was an advertising started off in Chicago at Leo Burnett, moved to Boston with Tim to go closer back to his mom, who was aging at the time. And we were
both in Chicago at the time.
Yeah, we met in Chicago.
Yeah.
But my introduction to food originally was when Tim and I were dating. And so Tim, when we started dating, we went to all sorts of restaurants. And I had never had Thai food. I'd never had Japanese food. I'd never had sushi. One of our first dates, we had sake, which is when I fell in love with sake, and probably Tim, maybe. But probably the sake more first than
Tim. It worked.
So, yeah, he got me a little buzzed on sake, and then we've been together ever since. So, my real exposure to food was just as a diner and somebody, you know, that loved food and restaurants and Tim's cooking and going out to restaurants. So, and when we met, there was no thought of opening our own restaurant at all. So I was serious in my advertising career and, you know, Tim was cooking and multiple restaurants and consulting eventually and worked for Let Us Entertain You and then consulting on his own. So, the idea for Oya kind of spawned from, Probably that first date, sushi and sake, and just our love for Japanese food and sake together.
That's one thing that I wanted to ask about, because, so, you know, I suppose you worked in with across many different cuisines when you worked with Let Us Entertain You, across numerous different restaurants. So you had, and you talked about your first introduction to kind of, I suppose, more exotic foods through cilantro and Mexican food. Mm-hmm. What was it about what was it about Japanese cuisine that got you hooked? What did you find so appealing about Japanese food?
Well, actually, all food appeals to me, period. I mean, I just love food. But when I moved to L.A. after graduating from music school in 1980 and got a job in a restaurant because it was down the street and I didn't have a car. And I wanted to actually work in a ski store, but I would have needed a car to go work there, so I couldn't take that job. So I took a job in a restaurant, and it just turned out to be a creative restaurant. It was in Manhattan Beach, California, and they had three restaurants, the owners, but it was right at the beginning of the California cuisine movement, and you know, which was happening mostly in San Francisco and L.A. And it took me a while. Part of it was initially I wanted money to just to pay my bills, but I also wanted to buy musical equipment, guitars and amps. So the first job that I had, I went in as a dishwasher and a line cook. And within 4 months, I actually ended up running the kitchen just because they went through two or three kitchen managers in that time. And I said, you know, I think I can do this. And so I asked them for the job, and they didn't want to give it to me because they thought I was just going to get out of band and go. And I guaranteed or told them I'd, you know, give them a 2-year commitment. And so they did. And then I just gradually fell in love with the whole thing. And I was going on auditions, but the food just started taking off. And then I went and worked with a couple other really good chefs in L.A., and that really opened me up to it. So I didn't have any real traditional background or training, and it was just very creative right from the get-go, and so I fit into it very easily. So that was really my...
That's an amazing you know, succession to go from dishwasher to managing a kitchen within the space of 4 months.
Yeah, it was. And it was... Yeah, it was quite a learning, and there were a lot of things I didn't know too. But they were supportive and helped me with it, and they were organized and structured, so it made it, you know, easy for me to do it. But you know, it's like anything; I was making mistakes, and you know, anything you try to do, it's.
And during that time in those formative years, was there something that drew you towards Japanese food more than others?
Well, about 4 years in, actually, I went to work at a restaurant, and this is. Restaurant name is going to be very familiar, but it's not related to the person you think it's going to be. The name of the restaurant was Trump's, and it was at no way related to Donald Trump. And it was in West Hollywood, and it was Michael Roberts with the chef, and it was a very creative restaurant. But we used a lot of Japanese ingredients there, but it was more California that used some Japanese ingredients. And then about a year or so later, I went and worked with a chef called Roy Yamaguchi. So he's born in Japan, spent a lot of time in Hawaii. He was French trained, and then had moved to L.A. So working with him, I got exposed to Japanese food. And also his food was also kind of California Japanese. It was European influence, but, you know, a lot of Japanese ingredients, but other cultural ingredients. I was the only one from the United States in the whole staff of the whole restaurant. Everyone was from Europe and Asia and all over the place, Southeast Asia, Mexico, Central America. You know, it was a huge thing. And so I learned a lot from just working with cooks and staff meals. So there was a guy from the Philippines, so I learned a lot about Filipino food and a ton about Mexican food and Thai food and, you know, from cooks and from people from the countries. So it was a great exchange to do that. But that was my first exposure. And then my first trip to Japan came about in 1988. I had moved to Chicago in 1987, so I was in L.A. for 7 years and started working with a restaurant group called Let Us Entertain You. And one of the first projects, I got hired as a corporate chef, so to speak, but it wasn't a corporate-y job. It was more just creative menu development. And we there was a restaurant group in, the first project that we did was going back to LA to open up a restaurant called Ed DeBevick's, which is an old 50s style diner, but it was a 300 seat diner. And across the street was Nobu Matsuhisa's first restaurant called Matsuhisa. And I went over and I fell in love with his food. And actually, Rich Melman said, you know, would you like to go spend some time in his kitchen? I said, sure. So I went over and he said, here's $1,000. Go see if he'll let you spend a week with him. And this was in 1988. So I went over and I said, you'd like to come in here for a week. Here's $1,000. And he said, okay. That was part of that. But then opening that in L.A., there was a restaurant group in Japan that came in to L.A. and loved that restaurant and wanted to open one in Osaka. So I ended up going over with the restaurant group and opening up the Ed DeBevick's in Osaka, and that was my first trip to Japan. And the Japanese culture being very giving and hospitable, and I was able to stay on that first trip for a couple of months and go around and do stages in Japan with an interpreter. They would take me into restaurants and, I'd get to ask questions, and I'd spend maybe a day or 2 days or 3 days in a restaurant and get exposed to all like true Japanese food in Japan. So that I ended up loving, but I've also spent time in Thailand and Hong Kong and Taiwan and China and Mexico and Italy and France and London or the British Isles and Germany. So a bunch of other places where I got exposure to all that food too. So all that comes into play in the food that we do, and especially at Oya. I mean, it's a very founded in Japanese basic flavors and foundations, but that's the jumping off point. So our rice is very traditional. We do sushi. Our soy technique and our ponzu and all our basics are very, very traditional. But we use that as a jumping off point. But any flavors that we add in creatively, they have to work with the rice and with the soy and the basic flavors so that it... I want it to taste... The way I imagine, at least for Oya, is that a chef from Japan... grew up in Japan as a chef, traveled around the world, learned all these new flavors, and then came back to Japan and did his version of, with the Japanese foundation, did his version of the food. So that's the sensibility that I communicate to all our chefs, and is that that's when we're working on new ideas, like that's what you want to do. You want to think in that sense.
And when you were together and 10 years ago when you were coming up with this, I'm sure there was, the merger and the collection between the two of you coming up with the concepts for it. So as you said, it was founded in Japanese cuisine, but what else was there? What else was there that, because this was going to be your first restaurant. This was going to be, where you're going to put all those efforts and the experiences and the knowledge into. What else did you want it to be emblematic of?
Well, we looked at, I think a lot of it has to do with the time. It was probably 14 years ago or 15 when we started thinking about it and started looking. It took us 3 years to find the right location. And it almost never happened because there weren't any liquor licenses available in Boston, unless you bought them off the street. But they're like anywhere from $200,000 to $400,000, and we didn't have the money. So we actually delayed the opening by a half a year because there was no liquor license available, and we almost never opened because of that. But what Nancy and I, what we did with Oya, we wanted to make it the way we like to dine. And so we knew that the price point was going to be in the most expensive restaurants in the country. And we hoped that there was a small audience that liked to dine in a more liked great food and was okay with that price point, but didn't want the pretense and the formality of dining on that level. So we made it very casual. We put our own music soundtracks together, made music part of the whole experience. What we really wanted to do was make, if somebody came in and just wanted to have one bite of sushi and have a beer and then go to the train station because it's nearby. We wanted them to feel as comfortable as somebody coming in and doing a full tasting menu. And we still, to that day, the same thing with Boston and New York. We have a la carte choices. So you really can come in and create, it's kind of the original affordable omakase, where you can come in and just order a la carte and you can spend whatever you want, as little as you want or as much as you want. And again, you will feel this comfortable. You don't have to feel obligated that you have to come in and do a full tasting menu. You can just come in and get a few bites, have a glass of wine. We have a great wine list, sake list, which Nancy can tell you about. But that's the most important vibe that we wanted to do. Or you could come in and really indulge if you wanted to. So there's a ton of flexibility. There's not a lot of... we don't want to hold people back if there's a table of four and one person wants to do a tasting menu, and that's fine. And then if somebody said, I have allergies or I don't like this kind of fish, we'll customize a tasting menu for you. And the other two people can order a la carte. So even though it's a lot more work for us, we don't require a whole table to do tasting menus. You know, you won't all be getting food at the same time if you're doing a full tasting menu, but it's just, it's, we think it's a lot more fun and a lot more flexible for people. And Nancy can talk to the service and the sake and wine.
Sorry, I think when you asked kind of how do we collaborate to design everything, and I think one of the things we always say is, like, we're not providing restaurants, we're providing experiences. So we want to make sure that everything that you touch, see, feel, hear is something specific and authentic to that restaurant, to that experience. And we say
the best quality.
And we love to surprise and delight. So surprise and delight is bigger than food and it's bigger than service and everything. It's how do we make the person that's coming in to dine with us as happy as possible before they leave?
And all the way down to the toilet paper.
Yeah, I've heard you're pretty, you go for the deluxe options on the toilet paper.
Yes, we do.
Charmin blue. So maybe overshare, but it's really nice. But we really, you know, it's the details. Like when we opened Oya New York, or Boston, the original, we actually mapped out in our backyard with string the entire kind of back line, the kitchen line and the sushi line, to make sure that the chefs would have enough room to move and open drawers and doors. And is it a left hinge door or a right hinge door? And in the kitchen, Tim had worked in so many kitchens where you're just stuck in the back and you don't know if it's daylight, nighttime, snowing, raining, what season it is. And so we actually, Tim insisted on putting two small windows in the kitchen so that you could see outside. It's an alley view. It's not awesome, but you can see outside.
It's better than nothing.
Yeah. And every contractor and the architect was like, what are you doing? Why are you spending money on this? Like, your budget's so tight to begin with. And that kind of sets the tone, I think, for just how we like to do things. We want to take care of our staff. We want to take care of our guests. And I think for me, coming from being a diner more than a restaurant person, I really bring the guest perspective. Like, to me, it's everything is about the guest and what are we doing to make the guest happy. And I think everybody in a restaurant will tell you that. But I didn't come from the rules and regulations and things you have to do in a restaurant, things
Which
you don't have to do.
So great.
Yeah. So I just approached it fresh. And it's like, do we really need to do that? No. Then why would we do that? Let's do it this way. So I think for us, it was a lot of fun because we could really create something exactly the way we want it. We had no investors. We did it on our own. We're total idiots. And we just put our house on the line.
Not that we had money.
Yeah. Like, we didn't have the money to do it. We just had a bank that was kind enough to give us a loan. And we signed over our house as collateral. And, you know, to this day, I just remember the pit in my stomach thinking about signing that document. I can envision it right now as we're sitting here.
Like, what's driving you towards that? You know, like, because... some people would say it's madness by, you know, committing to that so strongly. But I can only imagine that you had such a strong vision of what you wanted to create, that you saw diners sitting there eating and enjoying themselves, that it was all going to be worth it in the end.
Well, originally, I had been working on the food ideas for a really long time. And originally we were going to do it as an underground restaurant in our house. And then we looked into, so we had a spare room, so we were going to do, like, just, you know, ended up being pop-ups, but it was going to be an underground restaurant. And we thought about the legalities and the health department concerns and just, you know, neighbors and all that stuff. And it just didn't seem to make as much sense to do that. So that's when we just started looking for a location to do it. So I think it was more for me, and I don't want it to sound egotistical in any way, but it was, I felt it would be a shame that people didn't, if they couldn't taste this food in a restaurant. So it was partly kind of driven by that. It's like, because we were eating it, and we would have people over and kind of test it out on them, and you know, they'd tell us, oh, this is amazing. And
you need to have that confidence, though. If you're going to put so much on the line, you need to have confidence going into it that it's going to work.
Well, we didn't have confidence it was going to work. We had confidence in what it was.
different thing.
Yeah. No, we had full confidence that it was very good. And we always tell our staff, and we believe it, that there is no such thing as a best chef in the world or a best restaurant. But we wanted to be in that arena, and we believe we are, and that we were then. And so, I mean, we took a big chance. I mean, the first year was rough until we got some press, but we had prepared for it to be totally broke, which we were the first year. And then we got some good press almost exactly a year after, and then it's been on a wait list ever since.
And
so
I think for me, too, we did this together, obviously, but for me, and this is the way I judge a lot of things now, is that I really fast forward to the end of my life and say, will I regret not having tried this? And the answer was absolutely yes. Like, we had gone so far with the concept and what it could be and how we thought it was going to be, and was it risky and was it absolutely stupid? Yes. Like, no bank should have ever given us a loan. Like, just the... Thank you very much. I won't mention the bank, maybe. but
they're still giving us loans now.
But now they do. Yeah.
So we did pay the bank back.
Yeah. But truly, I think it's one of those things that, like, it's a risk that we shouldn't. My mom now tells me she was so ill, like, through this whole process, because she was so worried that we were just going to lose everything and go under. And, you know,
well, it sounds to me like you were very much so ahead of your time to take that concept 10 years ago, especially the idea that you can take something on at the highest level price point, but give an experience that, you know, is very welcoming to everyone. You know, especially in Brooklyn, you see it, that's the common thread nowadays. People want to produce high quality food, but it wants to be in a very comfortable setting. But that was not the case 10 years ago. And certainly if you were coming up with the concept 15 years ago, it was very much so the plush restaurants and then your mom and pop. So
yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people, when you had that concept then, were kind of thinking, is there a crowd for it? Will it work?
It was confusing for people. But that's why it's a small restaurant. And we knew it was going to work or it wasn't. I don't think there was going to be an in-between, because the location wasn't even good. And it's hard to find. I guess that ends up being kind of the charm, but it's...
Sometimes it is if it's a good place.
It was a hard to find place, but we really had no idea. We just hoped, you know, because it's only less than 40 seats and we're only open 5 nights. I did call some of my mentors and ask them. I said, one of them was Rich Melman, actually, from Let Us Entertain You. And I said, you know, we want to open a restaurant. And I told them exactly what it was and what the prices were. And I said, but we have a feeling like there's a small group in the world that would be attracted to that kind of restaurant. And he said, absolutely. He goes, I would go there. So it turned out, and actually we do get a very large international interest in the restaurants. I mean, every night, Nancy could probably tell you the percentage, but it's, you know, we kind of intended it that way, that it's a neighborhood restaurant, but it's still, it's almost like an international neighborhood restaurant, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's trademark that.
Well, one of my favorite quotes too, and again, it goes back to kind of how we like to dine, just like really great food in a really comfortable environment. And it didn't start with, we want to have an expensive price point. It kind of like, this is the experience and oh my gosh, actually this costs money because the ingredients are amazing and it's Japanese fish and it's, you know, it's in the Japanese realm. But one of my favorite quotes was early on from one of the guests that like freaked out, called me over and I thought something was wrong. And he's like, I just have to tell you, I can't believe that I'm sitting, I'm eating foie gras, I'm wearing my flip-flops, and I'm listening to Jimi Hendrix. And that was, like, so defining to really what we are and what we do. And some people get it and some people don't, and that's okay. But like at the end of the day, even if you're confused when you come in and go in, like at least hopefully we've surprised you in some way or given you something to smile about.
Well, we turned a lot of things on its head in doing it. Just the whole combination of we have a really good great wine list. We have Japanese whiskeys. We have great sake and beers. And so we wanted to appeal to a lot of people, and you know, where you could come in and kind of get a mix of Japanese flavors and Western flavors in a real casual place, and you had this great liquor selection or whatever you want to call it. And the whole restaurant's very simple and casual feeling. So we wanted the star of the restaurant to be the guests and having the food and the beverages with it. And that was the focus. Like there's not a lot of over-designed, you know, architects gone wild about, oh yeah, it's more about just coming in, sitting and relaxing and experiencing, you know, what's about to happen.
Well, it's very clear that you're very thoughtful in every act that you make. It's not just done for the case of, you know, making money or saving money. And something that I want to learn more about is, you know, as you expanded that into Cushman Concepts and what you've done further. But just before we get into that, we're going to go to a quick break.
I don't think there's anybody worthy to run this company but the people who built it. I have employees who've been with me for more than 30 years and plus. Each and every one of them deserves to be an owner. That's just the way it ought to be, and that's just the way it is.
This is Bob Moore. He and his wife Charlie started Bob's Red Mill almost 4 decades ago. Today they offer one of the largest lines of organic whole grain foods in the country. And in 2010, on his 81st birthday, Bob gifted ownership of the company to his employees.
I'd received plenty of offers to buy my company over the years, but selling out never felt like the right thing to do. When the time comes to let someone else run this show, I can't imagine selling it to a stranger. Giving the company to my hardworking employees just feels right.
The company now has an employee stock ownership plan, or ESOP. Stock is put in a retirement plan for all of its employees. When employees retire, the company buys back their shares. According to the National Center for Employee Ownership, about 11,000 companies in the U.S. currently run as ESOPs.
It just shows how much faith and trust Bob has in us.
That's Bo Thomas, the company's engineer and maintenance superintendent. He's been with Bob's Red Mill for over 27 years and has put his 4 children through college in the process.
For all of us, it's more than just a job. And obviously, it's the same way for Bob, too.
Bob is still very active in the company. He's the president and CEO, and you'll find him working at the mill just about every day. Because when you love something this much, you want to be a part of it.
Well, I may have given them the company, but the boss part is still mine.
Bob's Red Mill is committed to sharing only the freshest, best-tasting whole grain foods on the planet. Learn more about their mission of good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back to Why Food. I'm here with Nancy and Tim Cushman from Cushman Concepts. And just before the break, we were discussing their very first restaurant, Oh Yeah, and how they actually came to open that up after Nancy worked in the advertising world and Tim had his initial passion with music. So Oh Yeah is open. It's going well. You've gone through the initial hurdle of the difficult first year. You've now got a waiting list. You must be pretty proud. You must be pretty proud with what you've created. Was there a time where did you decide that you wanted to broaden your horizons and maybe go into different ventures?
Well, we knew that we could if we wanted to. But we didn't want to do it in a hurry. We wanted to make sure that it was the right time. So what we did, we just started going out and looking at locations to get the experience of just going in and negotiating a lease and all that. So we spent a couple of years looking all over the place and going in and sitting down with, you know, and going through the whole process and just learned a lot about going in and just finding a place and negotiating for it and all that. So we kind of put ourselves through school that way, and just looking for a location that we loved. And there was a lot of locations that were okay, but then you get in and it didn't seem like it was going to work out with the lease or the agreement. So that helped an enormous amount in getting the next thing. I think one of the things was our staff had been with us for so long that we wanted to create opportunities for them. So it was probably 7 years in, and the majority of our staff was all original. And so we wanted to create opportunities for them, and then we started getting invited to events, and we'd meet other chefs, and they said, oh, you should talk to so-and-so. You know, they, you know, make connections for chefs, for opportunities and all that. So it just kind of started happening, just kind of getting out in the world and getting exposed to things, and then people started offering us opportunities. And Hojoko we had in mind kind of at the same time as Oya, and ready to go with that. And I mean, there's a lot of other types of restaurants we could do if the opportunity came along. But we just want, if the right opportunity did come along, then we would take it, and we were prepared to do it. And we still look at it that same way. So it's really just kind of preparing us. It's luck is when preparation meets opportunity. So we prepared ourselves for the opportunity if it arose.
So you were never in a position to make a knee-jerk move. It was always prepared and planned and waiting until something came right.
Yeah.
And what's the concept for Hojoko?
Hojoko is kind of a rock and roll izakaya. It's a Japanese tavern with an amazing bar program and amazing food.
Japanese stoner food.
Pretty much.
There we go.
Yeah. And so this, as Tim was saying, that concept was in our minds and in our collective mind. And we kind of kept building the concept and in our minds, and actually in our basement, we would just buy things like across LA, Japan, Chicago, New York, and put it in our basement in the boxes and say, when we open this restaurant someday, we're going to pull all this stuff out of our basement.
I love it. That's very visionary of you, you know. Yeah. Well done. That's great, because you don't know where it is, but you can feel it in the distance, and you know it's going to come at some stage.
No, that's exactly. We'll be places, and we just buy stuff, and we go, I know we're going to use that.
We have another collection going right now for a future concept that we know we'll do someday, and it's all in the box in the basement. Can't say what it is yet.
I know people who do that, and I know people who are so against that, and some people will say that's very optimistic, and some people will say it's very unrealistic, but I think it's so realistic, you know, by putting it out there, creating that stuff, and exactly like you said, you know, you know that concept will come around to you when the time is right.
It's called planning ahead.
No,
that's a trademark, that one, Tim.
Yeah, that's a good one.
No, it's really, it's a Japanese tavern, rock and roll tavern. We have live bands, we have comedy nights, karaoke. What else do we have?
But also we take the food, what else do we have? We take the food really seriously. Like, it's all, we're applying the same kind of attention to the detail of the food, and the bar program's awesome. And, you know, it's really, and again, it's meant to be an experience. Like, when you walk in, whether it's to Oya or to Hojoko or to Covina or on the roof, it's like, we want you to feel like you're transported somewhere else for a couple hours of your life, and that we kind of, you kind of come into our cave for a couple hours and then go back into the world. But so Hojoko, we've actually had people walk in there and be so overwhelmed that they don't even know what to do. They kind of look around, because literally all the stuff came out of our basement and is now all on the walls and on the shelves and everywhere. And you can kind of discover something new every time.
But even from a food perspective, izakayas in Japan do cross-culture. So it's not always strictly Japanese food. There is Western food that gets worked into the mix. So we do the same thing there. We actually have a charcoal grill, so we do a lot of ribeye grilling. We do have sushi. We actually just, Boston Magazine picked Hojoko's cheeseburger, the best burger in Boston.
So we
got that. We also got Improper Bostonian picked it as best hotel bar in Boston. Actually Boston Magazine also picked Oya as the best restaurant in Boston again.
Congratulations.
So that's, and we're happy with that. But so you can go, because we set Oya's menu up the same way. We like to appeal. I always picture four people are going out to dinner. There's a lot of different tastes that are going on there. Some people like spicy, some don't. So somebody might want to have, you know, if you go to Hojoko, it's Japanese, they hear that. It's like, oh, you know, I don't like raw fish. Well, we have a great cheeseburger. We have a great hot dog called Dogzilla, where it's a smoky hot dog that's stuffed with cheese and jalapenos and wrapped in bacon and deep fried, and then it's kabayaki sauce and bonito flakes on top. But it's right near Fenway Park, so it totally works
there for it. Yeah.
So you can come, and we have great ramen. It's a chicken ramen, and we make the broth, you know, from it's that kind of creamy chicken, not with cream in it, but the texture of the long cooking of the bones. So we have ramen, we have sushi, and you can get a burger there. It's a fun menu. You can get vegetables. We do, you know, the charcoal grilled vegetables and stuff. So it's something that appeals to everybody. It's a great bar. There's a whole variety of cocktails and beers and sake. We do have canned sake there.
And with Cushman Concepts as the holding group of this, that oversees all this, you know, it's obviously each restaurant is like an individual child. You know, they have their own personality. I imagine if it's Oya Boston or Oya New York, there's variations. But as the parents overlooking all of this, you know, what's the vision for, you know, what you're creating with Cushman Concepts? Because you're going into Mediterranean food with Covina, and then you've got Japanese stoner food with Ojoku, or you've got fine dining and casual settings. Is there a vision as to what you want to create as a whole, or are you just very open into what you're going to create with each individual space?
Pleasure.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's really,
we're just obsessed with food, and we love good food, whether it is the highest end food and the fanciest thing on a plate ever or the cheeseburger. And we will dive deep into either one of those two things.
So as you move between the different establishments, mm-hmm. the relationship between either or doesn't vary.
Yeah. It's really fun, actually, even in New York here, because we're in the Park South Hotel. And so all three concepts, so Oya, which is high end, you know, contemporary Japanese, and then Covina, which is the Mediterranean, wood grilled.
California. It's kind style. Of California.
And then the roof, which is a rooftop. Majority, you know, bar is really the focus up there, and enjoying the views of the roof. And it's so fun. It's almost like it's the small world ride that on a nightly basis, if I'm in the restaurants and we're there and we're going from Oya to Covina, which are attached through the dishwashing area. And you literally go from like one world into another, and then to the rooftop, and then back through. And it's just, it's actually really fun. And the variety of that is actually really fun too, because we feel like we can kind of deliver a fun experience. And no one person wants to eat the same cuisine every day. So we all want different tastes at different times.
And I think to pick up what she's putting down,
he's hilarious.
A good example of that is we recently did I have no problem with shameless self promotion.
Give it out, come on, let's hear it.
We did Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds celebrated his 40th birthday there, so we they came in and we had
which place was this at?
At Oya.
At Oya.
But okay. So we had all the food from Oya, but then for dessert we had pizza from Covina. Yeah. So you get to experience both things, and because that's how we love to eat. Like, we might go and have sushi or something, then we'll have pizza afterwards. Alyssa, who is with us, knows that we do endless eating when we go.
And pretty much every meal ends with pizza or tacos. So that's what, selfishly, Covina, everybody kind of says they're a little confused, like, is it Italian? Is it not? And really the reason that Covina has a pizza oven, and this is the same pizza oven that we actually have in our backyard. It's a Stefano Ferrara oven. Tim was maybe going to do an Italian project with a couple people that he worked with like years ago. And he's like, I think I need to get this oven into practice. So talk about things in a box. This was actually like shipped over to us from Italy. Tim's brother and friends helped us build the Pizza Hut, we call it. So there's like an entire, it's nicer than our house, basically.
It's a pizzeria, with a bar in our backyard.
In your backyard.
Yes. Yeah.
What a dream.
I know.
That was before knowing that we were going to be doing Covina. So now actually we do have a practical application for this oven and why it's there. But
Has it been shipped out? You still have one in your backyard?
We have it in our backyard.
We have the backyard. No, we ended up keeping it there. Yeah. No, I spent a half a year working on the dough, which ended up, and that was about 5 or 6 years ago, which ended up being the pizza dough at Covina. But we also have wood, we have, you know, a wood grill there, so we do a lot of wood grilling. It's really, as I say, California, because it's hard to explain. It's not Italian. There's some Italian influences, Middle Eastern influences. It's really like a whole mix. But the flavors
from your California days of just open, kind of no boundaries for food,
yeah,
kind of thing.
And to touch on your extended love then beyond the world of food into the world of sake, you mentioned when you first met that you was that your first glass of sake?
That was my first glass of sake, one of our first dates.
And did your eyes roll back?
Yes. I mean, I loved it. I was like, what is this magical potion? And I loved everything about it. I loved the ritual around it, you know, the carafe and pouring, you know.
It was called number 9.
Magic potion.
Love potion number 9.
So this is what usually happens. I just ignore it and move on. So I just loved everything about it. It was like magical to me and mystical. And what is this beverage? And then so I just started reading everything I could about it, which was like one or two books at that time. It was in English. And
started drinking a lot.
Drank a lot of sake.
That's where you have to go. And yeah. If there's no more books, you have to drink it.
Somebody has to do the research.
Yeah.
Because I was in advertising, again, no thoughts of restaurants, no thoughts of Oya or anything. I just really genuinely loved sake.
And when people would come over, would you say, come over and we'll have a glass of sake? And
yes.
They'd say,
Yeah.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
And they'd be like, what is this? And it was really hard to find in Boston at that time, especially. Now it's everywhere. But back then, 10 years ago, that was 15 years ago.
That was almost 20 years ago when the first sake you had.
So anyways, I was in advertising and I was able to go to New York and LA for a lot of shoots that we were doing, commercial shoots or print shoots or TV. And so I made it a point to go to as many Japanese restaurants as I could in both New York and LA and try as much sake as I could on these shoots. And then I started taking notes on them and keeping a sake journal and tasting notes. And again, no thought of restaurants. It was just purely just for fun. And then when we really seriously started considering doing Oya, it was just a natural kind of progression into actually having a practical application for my sake drinking.
Uh-huh. And you found it. You definitely
found
did.
It.
Yeah. And you're both qualified advanced sake.
No, I am. No, Nancy is and Alyssa is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have a number of folks on our staff actually that are certified.
Yeah. I suppose both through Netflix and, you know, various means through the media, definitely sommeliers and wine drinking and a love for wine has been promoted and people know how you get on to reach the master sommelier. But how does it happen for sake? Is it the same kind of organized system where you have to go through different sets of exams?
Yeah, it's not as organized and as intense as wine is right now. I think that there's a motion to get it to that point. But when I started, John Gauntner actually is the gentleman who's actually born in Ohio and then he moved to Japan and
to teach
English and then he learned sake. And so it is an advanced sake professional certification through the Sake Education Council there. And so it involves tasting, it involves study at brewery, you know, you kind of do the whole thing. So and I would say it is just so it's still it's a newer and growing kind of interest and, you know, education around it, which is really fun to see now. Because I was in one of John Gauntner's first classes almost. It was like 15 years ago. And that was just from me. He was one of the two books in English. And he was crazy enough at the time. I don't know if he still does this, but he put his personal email in the book, published book. And so I would just email him questions just constantly. And then when he announced that he was starting these courses, he announced that he was doing these courses. And I said, I'm coming to Japan for your course. And he's like, I was wondering when I was going to hear from you. So I was able to go to one of his first classes, which was like in somebody's house. And it was in this beautiful, like, it was just, we were all sitting on the floor and just learning about sake and just.
Well, you must be so happy to see the change in the trends of sake nowadays and how appreciated it is. There's some great sake bars in New York as well that you can go to and just dig in and get to know it all.
And we really believe, you know, Tim and I both, like, we absolutely love wine. But for us, sake is such a really beautiful pairing with food and not just Japanese food. And it's very much more subtle than wine. It's not the loudest voice at the table necessarily. Sometimes wine can be a louder partner to the food. But sake almost
it's for food, us. Food friendly.
Yeah, it enhances
like beer.
It enhances. Yeah, so we're big sake and beer fans.
Well, it's been so great to have you here. I've really enjoyed it. Like I said, I wish we could have just stayed chatting for a long time on various other different things, be it in food or not. But unfortunately, we only have a limited amount of time today. And I'd really love to have you back on, you know, as Cushman Concepts expands and grows into various different forms. And hopefully we can come back and chat more then. But before we finish, got two great questions for you. And I was very lucky earlier on today to do an interview where both people on the other end, one had spent a long time in food, the other one hadn't. And we have the same pleasure today. Every interview I finish with, what has the food industry given you? So I'm going to start with you, Nancy. Since you got into it and since you opened up Oh Yeah 10 years ago, what do you feel the industry has given you?
A really amazing perspective on people.
Mm, yeah, I can imagine. What about you, Tim?
I agree with that. Also, it's shown me the world, which also gives you an amazing perspective on the world and people equally.
He copied me.
No, I said the world. You said people.
And if people want to find your restaurants, where can they be found? You've got three in Boston or two in Boston?
We have two in Boston. We have Oh Yeah at number 9 East Street in Boston.
That's and in the financial district near Chinatown.
Right near South Station.
South Station.
The train station. It's about a 5-minute walk from the train station. The other one, Hojoco, is...
In the Verb Hotel, actually.
Right
behind
Fenway Park.
Very easy to find. And then we're all three in New York are located in the Park South Hotel. And that's 28th between Park and Lexington.
Super. Well, I would implore anyone to go there. I've only had the pleasure of seeing the pictures, but from what I've seen, it just looks like incredible food. So thanks once again for coming out to Bushwick today to visit us. And hopefully we'll see you soon again on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I want to extend my thank you to the Heritage Radio Network for providing a platform for conversation across all matters involving food and drink. If you want to listen to more podcasts from this station, please visit heritageradionetwork.org. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and subscribe to the show. That small action has a huge reaction for the show's popularity. And most of all, I want to say thank you for listening to today's show. If you have a story to share of how you started in the food, beverage, or hospitality industry, please do get in touch and email me at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org, or you can message me on Instagram at whyfoodpodcast. Until next week, thank you very much, guys.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.